Those of you that were here this morning heard Mark's story about this fellow that she was with for a long time and has been with. And now for the next few minutes, he really isn't all that bad, and actually is a great friend. He has a great sense of humor and comes to us from London, Ontario, Canada. Hal, would you please come on up?
Hi, everybody. My name is Hal Robinson, and I'm an alcoholic. Real nice to be here. Nice to see you all. This is our fifth time here, and as your chairman tonight, I'd like to open this meeting, if we could, by welcoming you all to the Saturday night evening meeting of our Thanksgiving retreat. And in the usual way of opening all AA meetings, may we have a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer, please. May we have that moment now? The serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Conway said something very moving and very pertinent today, that tonight is going to be a big evening. Mark and I have been here for five consecutive Thanksgiving weekend retreats now, and the Shiloh Baptist Choir will be here. And for those of you who haven't been here for the Baptist Choir, it's a very, very moving and spiritual time. And of course, our speaker, I understand, is marvelous. So, by way of qualifying, may I say that I came to this program some 2,700 days ago, bankrupt in every department, morally, physically, and spiritually, and I hurt to my very soul. Through people like you and rooms like this, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a way of life and a fellowship and a spirituality and at times little snatches of serenity. And now with the AA program firmly enmeshed in Marg in my life, I don't have to hurt anymore. And that's a wonderful way to live. That generally qualifies me. I don't think anyone can come to this island without commenting on the spirituality and the serenity of this island. I made a little note because I have trouble remembering things when I get a little uptight or nervous. And it's simply that this island grants all of those who will accept it serenity. I have difficulty because of my emotions in expressing myself adequately under pressure. And I have to step back and be calm at times. And this island annually gives me that time, gives me that chance to step back and get whole and get healthy. I might comment that Mark and I have been married some 31 years, and whoever that fellow, I was on the road a lot of that time as a traveling salesman, and whoever that fellow was that she was talking about today, I'd sure like to meet him. Anybody in Al-Anon or contemplating going into Al-Anon, as Marg said in her remarks, she had a grievous time, a very difficult time accepting Al-Anon. And one of the few things I did try to do after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous was guide Marg into Al-Anon. And for whatever reasons, probably because I had controlled her life so much, she rejected it out of hand. And it took a mutual friend of ours who we invited to a Christmas dinner one time to lead Marg into Al-Anon, and for that we'll both be forever grateful. Now, I'm not the speaker tonight, and our speaker, Burns B., I've gotten to meet over breakfast and lunch the last couple days, and he's a marvelous, marvelous individual, great depth, great knowledge of Alcoholics Anonymous, and as an old-timer told me, and I listened to them ever since I came into this program, he's probably one of the best speakers you'll ever have a chance to hear. So we have a double bill tonight that you're going to enjoy very, very much. We have our speaker, Burns B., and the Shiloh Baptist Choir. So first of all, would you help me welcome Burns B.?
Thank you. Me too. My name is Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. It's a real pleasure and a treat to be introduced by someone that God loves so much he almost made him an American. And it's been one of the privileges and joys to get to know Hal and listen to Mark today. That's what happens at this retreat, or that's what it means certainly for me, is to get to add more people to this constant growing repertoire of friends and people I've come to love and trust all around the country. It's just a real joy, and Hal is no exception to that. Seeing a lot of familiar faces is also a real joy. You know, the ones that I've come to know over the years that were almost my gurus, you know. And Conway, that includes you. If I don't get drunk tonight, and I don't think it's necessary if you all go sleep with me. That's an option, I guess, if we want to talk about it. I don't know, Case, you want to help me work on that and see who we're right? But if I don't get drunk tonight, as of midnight tonight, I'll be sober 14 years. And for that, I'm very grateful. Thank you. I was in treatment in Atlanta and came back for 9 consecutive years to see CCAD. And I used to sit on the back row of clothes that he used to wear. And as I got closer, I began to see his features. You know, I realized he was only a handsome man, wears nice clothes. He came to be a genuine man. Over the years, I've always respected you, and now I'm beginning to feel like a true friend. You know, some interesting things have happened just during this couple of days that have let me know that. I mean, it's never been that we weren't friends, but it was difficult for me to reach a point in time in my recovery where I truly felt that I could sit with you and the Max Wisemans and the Hal Marleys and the Sandy Beaches. And it was nothing y'all did. And I think you know what I'm talking about is that process of recovery that wiped away the shame and the guilt and those kind of feelings of self-worth and no self-worth. And it's nice to be a friend of yours, and I appreciate being here. The spirituality of this conference is unrivaled, and I've been very fortunate to be able to articulate what this program has come to mean to me. I don't think I've ever been a place that brings so much peace into my heart. It's gotten to be the people. It really has gotten to be the people as much as anything else. Things happen. When I was sitting over there last night and we were talking about the ladies who are here from the halfway house or the residential program, and this one young lady's leaving. You know, you're graduating. And when that was said, 3 or 4 of them, the ones who could reach her, reached over and touched her. You know, they reached over and touched her, which said, "We love you." And I lived in a halfway house, and I came to know and love those people so much, and this was another blessing of this conference. The blessings happen each time I come. I saw love. I mean, real gut love. And that was a real joy. As I've come further along in my age, not necessarily my recovery, my head's kind of turned into Swiss cheese occasionally, and I don't remember things. You know, it's this NutraSweet problem that now causes you to forget things. And some of the younger ones saying, "I don't know what he's going to say." And the older ones saying, you see the white hairs and the bald heads going, like that. Well, I forget names. And I came in, and Frank and Betty, I love Frank. All the way down here, I couldn't wait to hope he was here. Walked up and called him Jack. You know, and that's just the way it is, you know. People like Martin, I don't forget Martin's name, but I guess that's because I feel like he and I got sober almost on the same day. It seemed like we've both been around, but I called him Jack. I've learned that my head just kind of goes out to lunch. I was giving a talk at Father Hilary's retreat one time, and right in the middle of the talk, I went blank. I could not remember anything. And he was sitting right beside me. I turned around to Father Hilary and I said, "Father, do you believe in the power of prayer?" And he said, "Yes, I do." And I said, "Then you better start praying or this meeting's over." a great story that some of the other people remember it. And Charlotte, I love you. I didn't mean to leave you out, but I'm female oriented, but male dominated. And I've always realized that. I just seem to orient to men. But Father Martin tells this wonderful story about this old priest. And he was about 95 years old, and he couldn't remember names. And so he'd figured out a way to put the names inside his lapel. And mine was still sharp, couldn't remember anything. So he got up there that night to celebrate the retirement of one of his young proteges, a 70-year-old priest who was retiring. So he got up and he says, "I am so grateful to be here celebrating the retirement of my dear friend, my true protege, my confidant, Father O'Reilly, who has been the parish priest in this wonderful parish, this parish that has been my parish for all these 70 years, the parish of St. Michael." Said, "Most of all, I'd like to commend Father for those years of undying service that he has given in the service of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ." So a couple of times here, I may flip in and say, "Jesus Christ." You know? So that happens. Just stay with me. Meeting may be over. We'll just keep going. I'd like to, I gave a talk in southern Indiana one time right across the river from Louisville and in New Albany. And it's a meeting I normally don't go to, but the people there know me and I know them. It's not that big a community in AA, really, in Louisville and across the river. But it's a meeting when I go in, they know I'm going to talk. I'm going to talk for a birthday of a friend or something of that nature. That night I walked in, one of the guys said, "Hey, Burns, are you talking tonight?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, keep it honest and keep it short." And I said, "Well, I'm not sure I can do both." And he said, "Then keep it short." Well, this may not be short, but it will be honest as I can make it. For people who may be new in the program, you may be laboring under a thing that I labored under for some time. If I came in and I was listening to a speaker that had the kind of build-up that you've heard me get, and those people who know me are laughing up their sleeve at that to some extent, but you've heard it, boy, you're going to hear a great circuit speaker. And boy, when I heard that, I'd walk in and sit down and I'd think, if I listen to this man, he's going to give me, or lady, they're going to give me the truth. They're going to give me the way, and I'll do exactly what they do, and I'll be able to stay sober. Well, some of these people had 15, 20, and 30 years of sobriety, and we weren't in the same spot. And I didn't almost get drunk, but I got crazy as hell trying to do what they were doing, and I wasn't in that same spot. So I do not want you to feel like what you hear from me is the truth. What I'm going to tell you, I'm not about to say, is the only way, the right way, or the best way to recover. It's what has happened in my life. Take what you need. Please understand, under no circumstances do I want to irritate anybody. I only want to help. Conway and I talked today. If there's a blessing in my life today, and I think Charlotte had talked about it too, I don't want to hurt anybody. And I work hard not to hurt anybody. But take what I can give you and use it. If it doesn't fit, then discard it. But please understand, this is my life as I've lived it. I have found one common denominator in all speakers. Everyone who's come up here and talked throughout this conference has a central core of pain. This disease of alcoholism leaves nothing. It leaves no soul. It leaves no hope. It leaves no ability to help. It just leaves a hollow, hollow pain. I've only found one power that is great enough to overcome that pain. And that's the power of love. When I was a little boy in the Baptist church in Mayfield, Kentucky, I used to rock in that little swing and they'd say, "God is love. God is love." When I came into this program and you asked me to turn my life and my will over to the power of God, I had no concept of what that meant. I did not reject it. I just had no concept. But I went back and hooked into God is love. God is love. That power of love can beat this disease. And it's the only thing I've ever found in my life and in the lives of people that I've been privileged to work with that can overcome its awesome destruction. It's the power of love. Power of love. I've only found two or three constants in this program of recovery. The first constant, the thing that has never changed thus far in my recovery, is constantly evolutions. My program is always undergoing change. People say that those are plateaus of growth. I don't relate to plateaus of growth. What I relate to are plateaus of surrender. Each time I've hit a wall, I have found another surrender. A surrender to God's infinite love and God's infinite power and my finite power. And what he has sent back to me through you is my responsibility. I wanted to impale myself at the third step and stop because I wanted to leave it right there. And the message came back, you just started. You have just started this journey. Plateaus of surrender and my responsibility. I've had to work hard at this program. I've had to work awfully hard at this program. And what I've learned each time I've hit that plateau is it's God's love. It's my limitless power, and it's my responsibility to do my job. The second constant I found is that I am powerless over alcohol. Alcohol beat me. It destroyed me. It left me nothing. When I'm in an AA meeting, I hear someone talk about, I don't know for sure if I'm powerless over alcohol. I just want to reach and grab them and hug them and say, please figure it out. Because this recovery process has been the second hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life. The first hardest thing was to drink like a normal person. Can't be done. It can't be done. But the second hardest was this program right here, the program of recovery. Finally, I knew it would take a power greater than me to restore me to sanity. I walked in knowing that. And I'm not talking about the insanity of drinking. You get anybody drunk, they'll act goofy. They don't act as goofy as I acted drunk. They don't act as goofy as most of y'all acted drunk, but they still act goofy. I'm talking about the insanity of sobriety. I've made more decisions and come to more conclusions that made no more sense sober than you can shake a stick at. The other day I was walking down the office in the hall in my office, and this has been about 6 months ago, and I just finally went in and closed the door and dropped on my knees, and I said, Dear God, how long have I got to service this insatiable ego? I wasn't talking about the ego of skydiving naked at the Super Bowl. I'm talking about the ego of not letting you go, of absolutely insisting on controlling your life, of living with those resentments that my partners won't do it my way, or I've got a nurse who hadn't got sense enough to draw blood. I couldn't let it go, and I was fed up with it, and I dropped down. I said, God, how long have I got to service this insatiable ego? I did the thing you taught me. I picked up the phone. I called my sponsor. We talked about it. I went to the meeting that night, and I shared this feeling. Two or three people talked. Finally, this one guy raised his hand. He's about my age, been in the program about 2 years. I was his sponsor. Well, it's been about three now. I was his sponsor for the first 2 years. And when it got his time, he said, Burns, he said, I don't know how long you got to deal with your ego, but you taught me you just had to deal with it for today. You know? Jumped up and bit me right in the butt. Didn't he? Wow, just like that. See, isn't it wonderful? What I found out is that AA program is not a pyramid, and anybody who makes it a pyramid either gets drunk or gets crazy. It's not only beautiful, but it's also very symbolic when we hold hands and get in a circle. We're in a circle. There's no pyramid. You know, tonight's guru in an AA meeting tomorrow night may not be able to pick his nose out threatening his brain. That's just the way it is. And vice versa. It never fails. That's just the way it is. There are no leaders in AA. Yeah, there's some of us who've been around a little longer, and I really look to those people. But I've watched some of them get to where they can't start their car without help. You know, they can't start their car without help. Alcoholism has been called a disease of perception, and I really know what that means to me. I can change anything I want to or could when I was drinking, and it allowed me to get drunk. I thought it was my ex-wife. Or, you know, if you've been married to her, you ought to get drunk too, or my snotty-nosed kids, and I was born poor. I couldn't belong to the country club. I had to caddy, all of those things to enable me to get drunk, and I got drunk. Well, my recovery has also been a difference in perception. Let me tell you a joke about perception. I need to tell you this is a joke in case you don't think it's funny, because then you'll laugh and you won't make me feel terribly rejected, so I always qualify this as a joke. Actually, it's a good joke, and I do tell it pretty good. Probably if you've heard it, that's all right. Laugh about it anyway. This is a story. I'm not an airline pilot, and I don't know anything about flying, so give me some poetic license. Pilot's sitting up there at 10,000 feet, and he's flying along in the plane. The ceiling's 100 feet off the ground, and the tower says you got one chance to land that plane, put that sucker on that runway and stop it, because that's the only chance you got. Now, you don't have to do it. And pilot says, I can do it. And he said, okay, remember, you got to stop it. So he brought that plane down through that 100-foot ceiling, put it on that runway, threw on those tires, the brakes, and the tires just squealed. The smoke came up off of the tires, and the nose of the plane came up, and just settled down.
pilot was sweating to beat hell. He turned around to the co-pilot. He said, I believe that's the shortest runway I've ever seen. Co-pilot was sitting there sweating. He looked right at him. He said, yeah, but did you notice how wide it is?
That's a great joke. I love that joke. I've been telling it for 10 years, and I still love it. Well, they had a common problem and a common solution, but they had a different perception of everything that went on. Well, that's what happened in my recovery. I grew up in a little town in western Kentucky named Mayfield. I was born into a home where there was no alcohol and there were no drugs. My grandfather died drinking lye water in the Mayfield City Jail. My mother was a product of that alcoholic home. She was molested physically, spiritually, sexually, and she brought all that shame and all that guilt and all that anger and all that resentment, all that no self-esteem, low home. She was a very loving, gentle lady. She is what we know today as a true adult child of an alcoholic. And am I getting into the controversy over anything like that? That's exactly right. Our book tells us without any qualms that if you're in the family afterward, when you grow up in a family where there's alcohol, everybody gets crazy. That's just, and Mother brought that into our home. Very loving, very supportive lady. The way it came out with us, my brother and me, is conditional love. When I was perfect, I was Mother's son. When I wasn't, I was Daddy's son. And there were times that neither one of them wanted me. But the fact of the matter is that I dealt with that conditional love by becoming perfect. I was dead perfect. Alcoholic home. I didn't get in an alcoholic home because my two children were raised in an alcoholic home. I have a daughter who's 30 who's been sober for 10 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a son, 26 or 25, who's been sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 years. When my daughter had been in AA for 5 years, she came and sat down with me and she said, Daddy, I need to talk with you. I said, sure, sissy. She said, when you'd come home sober, when I was a little girl, and you'd come in and we'd play together and talk and you'd hold me, she said, that was wonderful. She said, when you came in drunk and slapped Mother, I'd go up and go to bed and I'd pray, God, kill him. Just kill him. Let him die. And she said, Daddy, I hated you 1 minute and loved you the next. And I didn't know what to do. When those two young people stood up here today and started talking, and I flashed on that, and I tell you, it gutted me for a few minutes. I shared it with the young man, with Josh. I did not share it with the young lady. I just didn't. But boy, I flashed on that. And Mother had those feelings because she never had a way to deal with them. Fortunately for my children, they were able to deal with them. And fortunately for these children, they'll be able to deal with it too, because they're in a home today to cover it. But in that home, alcohol and drugs were no problem for me. I was perfect. You've seen my list of accomplishments. You thought one day I might be president of the United States, but you never thought I'd ever be a drunk. Alcohol and drugs, no problem. In high school, I got into college. Alcohol and drugs affected me almost differently from the first drink. I went to a college where there was a women's campus on one side of town, a men's campus on the other side of town, and that first semester I would study 5 nights a week, really learn my lessons, make good grades. On Saturday night, I'd go to the fraternity house. No one had ever told me how to deal with the fraternity house. I didn't know how. I was the first Brady who ever went to college. I really had no source of reference. And I'd go over on Saturday night and get drunk. We'd all pile on the back of a flatbed truck, drive over to the women's campus, and we'd just serenade the women. Well, right in the middle of serenading these girls, I'd always take off all my clothes, stand there buck naked, just singing up a storm. You know, I say, there were no cards, there were no flowers, no phone calls, nothing like that. Well, I'll tell you who did notice. The dean noticed. Yeah. And the dean called me in and he said, Burns said, you're a good student, and we think it's the drinking that does it. Why don't you quit drinking? I quit drinking. It was no problem and everything cleared up. I got into medical. So there were 100 of us. We went into this room and would be doctors. And I looked around at these other 99 people who are going to be doctors, and they looked like they should be doctors. Inside here, I didn't think so. Doctors were special people. All of my life, I've been fighting that. I feel different. You look great. I don't feel as good as you look. I mean, I'm talking about tonight. Now, tonight's different because you're my friends, but I mean, it comes back and I won't feel like I'm as good as you look. It's been there and it's something I have to deal with on a daily basis. It's better than it's ever been, but boy, back then, these people were gonna be doctors. That was ridiculous. I couldn't be a doctor. So I packed up my clothes to go home. Could not study. Couldn't remember. I mean, it was out of the question to try to do my homework. As I started to leave after 2 weeks, a good friend of mine brought in an amphetamine, Speed, handed it to me and said, take this. And I took that, and you didn't look different. You didn't look different. I could be a doctor like you. And I mean, tell you, I started studying voraciously. Now, almost everybody in medical school at that time took amphetamine. There was a difference. Almost everybody else quit. I didn't. 2 months or 2 weeks before graduation, my senior year, I was kicked out for beating up one of my medicine professors when I was in an amphetamine rage. They took me down to the head of the Department of Psychiatry, Dr. Keller, and he looked at me and he said, Burns, said, what's wrong with you? I said, Dr. Keller, I take too many drugs. And he said, do you believe that? And I said, yes, sir, I do. He said, we can help you. And I said, what do you want me to do? And he said, we want a psychiatric therapy. And I said, all right. He said, we want you, what it is that makes you take that dope. And once you figure out what it is that makes you take that dope, you can quit. You're going to think yourself into a way of acting. You're going to think yourself into a way of acting. That was their perception of my recovery. Now, I got to tell you real quick, I'm not anti-psychiatry. Neither is the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And some major influences were things that he wrote. Thibault, for example, was a major influence in his life, or at least to the best of my ability to study. No, I'm not anti-psychiatry. I'm anti-ignorance, and thank God I've been given the ability to in some way eradicate some of the ignorance in the medical profession and to bring some appropriate insight into the AA community as far as obsession. We've certainly enlarged on what he meant. We have not changed it. We've just enlarged on it. But psychiatry helped me. Psychiatry taught me how to identify. They didn't keep me from taking dope, but they did help me. They taught me how to identify a feeling. They brought me some insight. They brought me some knowledge. 15 you, and you put the cap on the problem. You brought me the spiritual solution. You brought me the spiritual solution. Oh, I was angry at psychiatry for some years because they didn't bring me a spiritual solution. Then I read their contract, and it doesn't say psychiatry is going to bring me a spiritual solution. I got mad at you because you couldn't be therapist. I wanted AA to be therapy. I wanted it to be my therapist. And you're looking at one can click into doing that pseudo-therapy just like that in an AA meeting until some very wise spiritual solution through our experience, strength, and hope. And the combination of the two has been an incredible thing in my life. It's that kind of four-step. That's exactly what the four-step is for me. It is how to identify that feeling and start a journey to ask God to remove it while I clean house and help others. It's that simple. At the end of a year and a half, I talked to the psychiatrist. And they said, how do you feel? And I said, I'm afraid. And they said, why are you afraid? And I said, because I'm going back into school. Well, what does that mean? Well, they'll be watching me. Well, should they be watching you? Well, yes, they should be watching me. Well, why should they be watching? Because I slapped one of them. And said, own you. You know the feeling. You can own the feeling. I said, right. That makes sense. That's cognitive. That's cause and effect. It should work. Walked right back into medical school, and I was hiring a kite in 45 minutes. Couldn't figure out why. Just hiring a kite. My classmates took me home. They'd put me to bed. My wife would put me to bed. I was married at that time with one small child. You know what I've come to know today? It takes everything that's been in this program for me. They didn't enable me. They just supported me till God could get me to you. Oh, I was angry at them for a while. If they'd have treated me right then, I would not be where I am today. Well, it took what it took. I went home that year, I guess conservatively, 15 to 45 times with the flu. They knew what I had. They knew I was still taking dope, but they didn't know what to do. And some of those people who are still alive today told me, they said, Burns, the reason we didn't kick you back out of school is because you were such a good person. Hear that? A good person. Think about the people we've come to know and love in AA. Goodness, as wide as we are. Good people. Oh, we have tough times seeing it. And a lot of road of recovery to travel. But good people. And they saw that goodness in me then. Long before I think I had it, they said, Burns, we think you'll make a good doctor. We thought it back then. We didn't know what to do with you. But you were such a nice person, we didn't want to kick you out of medicine. Graduated in 1964, and between 1964 and 1970, I was in Our Lady of Peace, a mental hospital in Louisville, four times, strapped down, IV fluid, straitjackets, padded cells, the whole bit. Each time I'd get too hot, the board of licensure would come and say, Burns, please quit. And I'd quit. Maybe 6 months, maybe 2 weeks, maybe a year, I'd quit, but I always went back. In 1967, I went in the Army. They made me the officer in charge of the dispensary. That's right. I had the only key to the pharmacy. That's like putting a fox in a chicken house, isn't it? That's exactly what it boils down to. Well, I figured out this ingenious thing that if I took these capsules, they'd catch me. So I would, the little beads in amphetamine. So I'd take off that top cap and I'd take two beads at a time. You know, it takes about a week to empty a capsule, two beads at a time, you know? It's a real delusional problem. We can believe anything. A perception, a disease of perception. And they finally came and said, we know you're getting the amphetamine. If you don't quit, we'll kick you out of the army. So I quit. Stayed out, quit a year. Came back home in 1969. Got back on them again for about 6 months. And finally in 1970, I said, I'm destroying my life. I wonder what's doing it. Why are they putting it? I said, I bet it's those drugs. Took me 12 years, but y'all figured that sucker out pretty quick, didn't you? Y'all figured it out. Took me 12 years. So my last amphetamine was in 1970. My last drug without doctor's prescription, literally, except for occasional Valium when I was shaking so bad coming off the alcohol. I've never had any other drugs except under doctor's care. Then I started drinking. First, I drank for 4 years. I didn't drink alcoholically. I got drunk a lot, but I didn't set out to get drunk. I didn't set out to stay sober. I didn't set out to go to restaurants that only served alcohol. I didn't set out to have friends who only drank. I didn't set out to go to UK football games and hope I'd make it through the half. No, alcohol was not an obsession with me. Finally, I drank 3 years alcoholically, where if you didn't drink, you were not my friend. If there wasn't a restaurant that served alcohol, we didn't go. I would titrate myself to third quarter of the football game. The idea of making it out of the parking lot was out of the question. But that was drinking alcoholically. Every obsession, every thought was alcohol. Heard somebody say, in fact, Stanley Getlow said one time, said, you want to diagnose an alcoholic? Said, you have a problem with alcohol. Well, no, I can control it. Then you got a problem with alcohol. Tonight, I ate before we came over here, and I limited myself to 4 celery sticks. Right? You say, man's got a celery problem, right? It's that simple. But nevertheless, in the lately, I drank to stay alive. I drank a quart of whiskey a night. A quart of whiskey a night. But I wasn't an alcoholic. You know why? I never drank in my office. Now, after I got in this program, I had to be honest. I looked back at the last 6 months of my drinking, and my office hours consisted of 15. That's right. 5 minutes to get there, 5 minutes to look at the mail, and 5 minutes to get the hell out, because I knew I had to get home and get drunk. And I did go home, and I'd get drunk. Finally, December the 1st, 1977, as best I can ascertain it, actually it's probably about 2 or 3 days before that, I went home, and Casey, who has been my dearest cheerleader, and she and I were living together at that time, and my wife and I were divorced. She should have kicked me out years before. She did not. Very sick relationship. Had been sick from its inception. Finally, I gave her no choice through my behavior. She kicked me out. I ran around and raised hell for about a year, and then met Casey, and she immediately we became the kind of people that has enabled us to survive. And that morning I got up, and she'd gone, and I knew it was over. I knew I could not drink. It was killing me. I knew I couldn't kill me. Out there in that world, without something in me, I can't do it. When we read A Vision for You, it said, there will come a day when you can't live with it, and you can't live without it. And I hope if you belong in this program, you reach that point. Because that was one of God's greatest gifts to me. I did not know what to do, so I sat there and I finally thought, I know what to do. And the peace that came over me is indescribable. I went and loaded my shotgun, put it in my mouth to take my life. Totally at peace with suicide. I was not scared of dying. It was a relief. I was scared to death of living. Scared to death of living. When I became aware of a burning desire to live, I went to the phone, called a good friend of mine, a psychiatrist, said, please help me. He said, come talk in the hospital. I looked out Our Lady of Peace, and I said, David, I don't want to go in that hospital. I've been in there 4 times. It never works. But I'll do anything you tell me to do. I'll do anything to do. I became teachable. I was getting ready for y'all. I was getting ready for y'all. He said, you won't go there. So he sent me to a psychiatric hospital in New York. I was there for 10 days, transferred me to an alcohol treatment center in Atlanta for 28 days, transferred me to a halfway house for 2 months, sent me home, and I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. I found nothing unique in anything that is said to me. I found some wonderful messages that God has given each of us to carry to someone who needs to hear it. My message that probably is unique is that I took one drug for 12 years. It nearly destroyed me. I took another drug for 8 years. It nearly destroyed me. For an alcoholic of my type, no mood-altering drug will work in my body. I can take an antihistamine and go over there and sit down by Barney, and I'll end up just counting my toes and playing with myself, you know, just playing around. Counting, you know, 6 toes one time, 12 toes next. Doesn't make any difference to me. Active fed, you can forget it. I take a lot, when I'm working out a problem, I'll sit down and I'll do a fourth and then a fifth step and go sit and talk to my sponsor. And he'll, if it makes some sense, he'll say, try that. And if it doesn't, he'll say, you know, that may work for you. I've never, ever seen it work for anybody else, but it may work for you. Well, if there's anybody out there who's got an alcohol problem and they're, you know, they're ready to give up their alcohol, but they think maybe they'll smoke a little dope, or maybe they got a dope problem, maybe they give it up, they'll drink a little alcohol, or maybe you'll take a little, you know, you're nervous, so maybe you'll take a little bit of Valium, or it's tough sleeping in that first 2 years, maybe you need a sleeping pill. It may work for you. But if you're an alcoholic of my type, I ain't ever seen it work for anybody else. So if my experience means anything, please use it. I came into you people, I was beaten, and I said, what have I got to do? And you said, you do anything we tell you to do. You're going to act yourself into a way of thinking. You're going to act yourself into a way of thinking. I said, all right, what does that mean? What do I do? You said, don't drink, go to meetings, and read the big book. Never changes, does it? It's wonderful, isn't it? You know why they make it that simple? For people like me. And I imagine for people like a lot of y'all. You know, we can take a plate of spaghetti and screw around with it for a while and make it even more mixed up. You know, that's the way I am. So they made it simple. I said, all right, don't drink. Go to meetings and read the big book. Don't drink. Okay, don't drink. Why do they spend so damn much time on that? They just beat that to death. Don't drink. Don't drink. I know don't drink. Then I heard Sandy's tape. When he said every time he got drunk, it was a direct result of drinking. And I thought, the man's a genius. He's got it figured out. You know, isn't that wonderful? He's got it figured out. Well, I was ready, and boy, it lit me up. You know, don't drink. If you don't get drunk, don't drink. Okay, don't drink. Go to meetings. All right, go to meetings. Now, let me reflect on what meetings have meant for me over these years. Let's go back to that home that I grew up in. When I was a junior in high school, I came home one night after a football game, and I'd had a couple of beers with the guys. I just got sick, and I walked into the living room and threw up, and Daddy came out and looked at me, and he said, Burns Mac, you've had something to drink. I said, yes, sir, I've had 2 beers. And he said, you're not really drunk. And I said, no, sir. He said, you really are sick. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, here, I'll help you clean it up, and then tomorrow we'll talk about it. Well, I went on up to start to go to bed, and as I started up the stairs, my mother came running out of the bedroom, grabbed me by the hair of the head, and went, wow, 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 you little bastard, I'll never talk to you again. Took me 8 years of psychiatric therapy and a number of fourth and fifth steps to ever be able to break through and remember exactly what I thought. In my home, you wouldn't have said it. And I'm glad I was in a home like that. But I remember looking at her and I thought, and I'll never trust you, you bitch. And when I came into this program, I didn't trust you either. I didn't trust anybody. I'd been deacon in 5 churches. 8 years of psychiatric therapy. They each brought me something, but they didn't keep me sober. And if you didn't have the answer, I was dead, and I didn't trust a one of you. And what I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous is it's a perfect program composed of a lot of real sick people in varying degrees of recovery. And by God, there's some of us you can't trust. And that's just the way it is. You know, it's just the way it is. My first fifth step in the fifth in the sixth chapter dealing with the fifth step, it talks about confidentiality being essential. My first fifth step should have been on the front page of the Courier Journal, the Louisville newspaper. And I mean, I looked at people early in this program, and some of them wanted to take my wife out and get in her pants. Some of them wanted, and I understood that. Some of them wanted to take me out and get in my pants. I never quite understood that. You know, I really didn't. There were people who wanted to borrow money, and they did. There were people who didn't intend to pay it back, and they didn't. And I went from meeting to meeting, and I'd look in their eyes, and I couldn't tell who had on the white hats and the black hats. And finally I said, why do you want to take me out to have coffee? And they'd say, because we want to stay sober, and we want to help you stay sober. And I began to find the winners by that. And I'd sit down, and I began to trust. And I've heard people earlier in the program say, I'm not going back to that meeting. So-and-so said this. Well, then find another meeting. But if you keep looking in people's eyes, you'll find somebody home someday. And it won't take that long. And when they want to take you out to coffee because they want to stay sober,
And they want you to stay sober, then go. Because this program has winners. And I had to find them, and I did, and I began to trust. Then I found out that them that don't go to meetings don't hear what happens to them that don't go to meetings. You know? Old Jim W. from Texas said when he came in the program, he had a sponsor that'd grab him and take him to a meeting. He'd hide from him. He said he'd find me, and he'd drag me off to me. He said, I'd hide, and he'd find me and drag me off to me. He said, one night I hid so well he couldn't find me. So the next day he called me, and he said, well, Jim, you missed it last night. And he said, what's that? And he said, well, you didn't hear what you were supposed to hear. He said, well, what was it? He said, oh, I don't know. I heard what I was supposed to hear, but you'll never know what you were supposed to hear. You know? And I began to look at this. And then early in recovery, I'd see these people come in that had slips. And I'd go to my sponsor and I'd say, can I talk to that guy? I want to ask him why he drank again. Sometimes Jim would say, no, you talk to that one. He'll smack all your teeth out. But yeah, he'd say, go talk to that one. I'd sit down and I'd talk. And every single time, boil away all the other fluff. But it got down to they quit going to meetings. They quit going to meetings. And I found that common denominator of the fellowship and the love. They quit going to meetings. I gave this talk in Chicago not too long ago, and this guy came up to me after I finished. He said, well, let me tell you something. I went to meetings for 2 years, was drunk every night I went. So your story's wrong. And I said, well, congratulations. You've impressed the hell out of me. And so the whole idea was, you know, his grandiosity almost was killing him. Don't quit going to meetings. 8 years in this program, I became a real devout student of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really did take it into my head, into my heart, and I live by it on a daily basis today. And I know that book not as well as some other people perhaps in this room, but I know it real well. And what I found in There Is a Solution is the crux of alcoholism. There will come a day when we will be unable with sufficient force to bring back into our conscious awareness the humiliation of that last drink. We forget what happened to us. When I'm lecturing to a group of doctors, now I've got every formula under God's green earth up there, and they get through and they're totally impressed. They'll finally say, but why do y'all ever drink again? I said, because we forgot what happened to us the last time. Oh, come on, it can't be that simple. It is that simple. We forget. It is a peculiar mental twist which leads to forgetting. Every time I walk in that back door, I'm gently reminded of what I am. Through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book, the 12 steps therein, and the wonderful chapter, The Family Afterward and the Vision for You, a God of my understanding, I have come to know who I am. The day I quit walking in those doors and forget what I am, you can bet the farm I will lose who I am. You can bet it. You can bet it. And I also go to meetings today because I'm home. I'm home here. I'm home in Louisville. I'm home in Albuquerque. I'm home in San Francisco. I walk in and I am home. This is where I want to be. This is my family. I would not choose to be anywhere else on the face of God's earth. This program is my supreme gift. You are me, and I am you, and I am home. Don't drink, go to meetings, and read the big book. So I got the big book, and I'd set it down, and I'd start to read, and I think I'd close, and I can't remember it. I'd open it again, and I'd read, and I'd close, I can't remember it. I'd go to the meeting, I'd say, I can't remember anything. You'd say, hell, don't worry about it. None of us can. I'd say, how long does it last? About 6 months, 2 years. Does it go away? It always goes away. And I'd come back next night and say, I can't remember anything because I forgot what you told me the night before, you know? Oh, yes. When I went into treatment, I was drinking a quarter of whiskey a night. I walked into treatment center, and I asked to go into treatment. Sat down in front of the guy who ran the treatment center. He looked at me and said, Burns, how much do you drink? I said, I drink a six-pack of beer every night. He said, you're lying. I said, I know it. I do it all the time. Why'd I do that? Oh, yeah. I used to lose my car when I was drinking. You know, I used to lose my car when I was drinking. I lost my car when I was sober. One day I went to work and I drove my car in and I drove Casey's car and I parked it and I came out and I thought that somebody'd stolen my car. I walked back in. I said, Dave, they stole my car. And he walked out in my partner. He looked and he said,
No, Burns, you drove Casey's car. So we solved the problem. They gave me a parking place. And the story was that when Burns leaves, he's going to that parking place, and if he can get whatever's in it started, he's going to drive it home. Yeah. And I can just think of Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob sitting there talking somewhere between 1936 and 1937. And Dr. Bob says to Bill, "How you doing?" Bill says, "I'm doing fine." He said, "How's your memory?" And he said, "Oh, it's getting better. How was that first year?" He said, "It was wonderful, but my head was just like sawdust." He said, "Well, maybe we shouldn't make any major decisions for 1 year." In 1975, they studied us. Medical science study that. They said, the alcoholic will lose the power of retentive memory for recent events for 6 months, 2 years. Sleep patterns will be destroyed. I used to tell me, "I can't sleep." And said, "Nobody ever died from lack of sleep." No compassion. Simple problem solving and stress management will be destroyed. And if you're in that first 6 months, 2 years of this program, stick with us. It'll clear up. You're going to be fine. I gave this talk in Bull Shoals. You remember that night? Bull Shoals, Arkansas, in a big old tent like a Baptist revival. And I'd been to 100 of those, I guess. And I had that big old tent, and there was a kid sitting back there about where you're sitting, slouched down in his chair with his hat looking. I didn't know whether he had a gun or a grenade or a big book. I didn't know what he had, you know. And about halfway when I got to that point, I said, "Stick around, it'll be okay." He jumped up and said, "Hallelujah, I thought I'd lost my mind." And I knew where I was supposed to be at that meeting, you know. I really did know. Well, I decided, well, if I don't drink, go to meetings, read the big book. If I can't read the big book, what am I going to do? How's it going to work? I don't think it'll work. Me, dear God, how's it going to work? And I remember how it works. We read how it works. So I got that, and I opened the thing, and I started reading how it works, and I saw that anybody can make it if they can be honest. You know, may have grave emotional and mental disorders, but you can be honest. It said, rarely, and these people that are rarely are sociopaths. Max knows that. Many other people do. These are people who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. I've had people I worked with in the program say, "I guess I'm a rarely. I'm constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself." And I say, "Hey, man, Wilson was talking about a small segment of people called sociopaths. There aren't many sociopaths, but there are an awful lot of liars. You know, awful lot of liars. You know, and I was a liar, and I shared that story out of sync because my mind went somewhere about where I would just lie about everything. And I used to play golf. I used to play golf, and I would hit my ball on the green. And I'd go up there because it meant don't drink, go to meetings, and don't tell lies. That's what it meant. Don't drink, go to meetings, and don't tell lies. By God, I could be honest. I figured I'd play golf before I went into treatment. I'd hit my ball on the green, and I'd go up there, and then my ball would be sitting there, and I'd spot the dime in front of the ball. I'd come back and take my ball and spot it in front of the dime. And I'd do it over and over. I just saved myself a fourth of an inch on a 40-foot putt. And I'd just do it all the time. I just hated my guts, but I did it over and over. I came back from treatment. That next summer, I played golf, and I'd hit that ball on the green. I'd walk up there, and I'd spot that ball right. I'd spot that ball right, and I felt better about myself. I couldn't walk, talk, and chew gum. They said, "You ask Burns Brady anything, and he'll tell you the truth." It probably won't have anything to do with what you're talking about, but he'll tell you the truth. And that was the fact. You know, that was a fact. And I could tell the truth. I hated myself when I went off treatment. I felt better when I came home, but I didn't know how to organize things. And I began to feel good about me because I could tell the truth. I could tell the truth. It was that simple. I've had people say that's cash register honesty. It means as much to me today as it meant then. Cash register honesty. We're only as sick as our secrets. And a secret is when I know I've told you a lie. I don't care if it's making change, going to the grocery store, spotting a golf ball. For me, the very first lie, no matter how inconsequential or delusional, leads to an unbelievable vortex of lying, which ends up with a delusion that has led me to believe that feces doesn't stink and black is white. And that ain't true. But by God, it's got me there just like that. And I believe in cash register honesty for this drunk as much today as I believed it the day I walked in this program. And I said, "Well, you got to be honest with yourself." I agree with that. There's a hooker in that. If this is a disease of perception, it's proved to be true for me that way, then there are times I simply don't know when I'm being honest with myself. I simply don't know. Clancy tells a wonderful story, and it really says it. He said when he was 20 years sober, he was sitting up there at 20,000 feet, he and God, and they were flying along. They were looking down at the ground, and he said, God, they're looking over us. He said, God, how are those alcoholics doing? He said, God said, Clancy, they're doing fine. He said, God, how am I doing? He said, you're doing fine, Clancy. I bet you could have a light beer. Hear it? Hear it? Ten Step says, alcohol is subtle. Cunning, baffling, and powerful, I understand that. But what I relate to is alcohol is subtle. We're not cured of our alcoholism. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. My spiritual condition is established and maintained with a sponsor, a home group, about 8 guys who know my breath stinks before I ever get out of bed, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the 12 steps contained therein. And I can establish and maintain a spiritual condition. I know the 11th step directs me to pray for the inspiration of prayer, and I have known it. But I have known the complete delusion of prayer, too, in isolation. I came to know that this program is prayer and share. Prayer and share. Share the prayer. Share the prayer. Each day we'll be faced with self-centeredness right out of the 10 steps. Self-centeredness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. What do? We ask God to remove it. We talk to somebody, and we help somebody. It takes that whole spectrum for me. And then I can be honest with myself. I won't belabor the number of times that I have known the complete delusion of isolated prayer. Finally, if you ever heard me talk in the first 8 years of my recovery, you didn't hear much about the big book. I grew up in a recovery process that talked about it. It took me 5 years to go through the whole 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. 5 years. 5 years. 8 years in the program, I became a real student of this big book, and I got to tell you right now, it is my roadmap. It is my roadmap to sanity. It is my roadmap where the delusion of what I can drink again is never comes back. You told me when I came in this program, you stop the drinking and don't deal with the thinking. You go back to the drinking. You also told me that alcohol is only a symptom right out of the big book, and the bottle is only a symbol. If my problem was just alcohol, the minute I came home from detox, I'd be fine. But that's when it started, with the ism. As I have studied this big book, the road has narrowed. The road has narrowed and become exceedingly simple. The road has narrowed. The horizon has broadened. Today I can go places and do things I never thought I could ever do and places I never thought I could ever go, because my insanity is kept between the curbs by the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the big book of AA. If that means anything to you, follow it. But I've seen people get impaled on following all sorts of concepts of recovery and have never gotten down to the fundamentals of reading our textbook. Reading our textbook. The last year of my drinking was always the same. I'd get up in the morning at 11 o'clock. I couldn't get up any earlier. I'd finally gone to sleep about 8 o'clock because I'd been drinking all night long. I would race to the office to do in 2 hours what I now takes me 8 to 10 hours to do. I would come home as quickly as I could get home. Casey'd have my broil steak and baked potato. Being a doctor, I knew I was destroying my liver. I thought about not drinking, but that is out of the question, so I always knew to eat so I wouldn't destroy my liver. I'd choke down that broil steak and baked potato, and I'd get my quart of whiskey in my glass and sit down. I'd get my first record of the evening, which was the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, the Philadelphia Philharmonic Orchestra doing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming, and I just cry. It's a great song. I still cry when I listen to it. It's a wonderful song. Difference in tears today. 5 hours I'd play that sucker, and then I'd take it off, and I'd put on the next one, which was Neil Diamond's I Am, I Cried. And that Neil Diamond's in a motel, probably in Mayfield, trying to figure out whether he belongs on the East Coast or the West Coast, and he's talking to a chair. Now, Neil had a problem about that time. You got to know he did. And he'd say, I am, I cried, and I'd go, God, Neil, I know what you mean. Oh, I know what you mean. Listen to that song. Here's what he says. I've got an emptiness deep inside, and it won't let me go. I'm not a man who likes to swear, but I never cared for the sound of being alone. Does that sound familiar? When I was drinking, I could be by myself. Or when I was drinking, I could be in a crowd, and I'd be all alone. Today, I can be by myself, but I'm never alone. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then I will promise you, as it was promised to me, there will come a day when you'll never walk alone. I can ride down the streets in my car, and I reach over and I take my God's hand. And when I take his hand, I see your faces. I see your faces. And I'm never alone. That morning I got up out of bed. I knew it was over. I went to see David. And David said, "Burns, how do you feel?" And I said, "I'm depressed." And he said, "Do you think it's your drinking?" And I said, "David, I'm depressed." "Well, maybe it's because you drink too much." "David, are you listening? I'm depressed. I nearly blew my brains out. I'm depressed." "Well, maybe you shouldn't drink. I know I drink too damn much, but I'm depressed." 100% of us come in this program are depressed. Only about 6% of us need medication. And you can't tell that for almost 2 years. So you just stick around us and we'll help figure that out for you. Because I stuck around severely depressed. And let me tell you, there are a lot of people in AA today trying to practice medicine without a license. There are also a lot of people in medicine today who don't understand spiritual solutions. And thank God for all of us who can carry a message. And I'm very grateful to be a physician with a team of physicians that are beginning to carry that message to both sides of the fence. I'm very grateful for that. David said he couldn't jar me from that depression, so he sent me off to treatment in a mental hospital in New York that made One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest look like a walk through Central Park. And his whole purpose was to scare me into recognizing my problem. He didn't know any better. When I got there, it's the fourth floor of this hospital in New York, and they had the murderers, the pillagers, the plunderers, they had us all, the alcoholics, and they didn't believe in detox. Now, let me tell you, 15% of people who try to come off alcohol abruptly go into DTs, and 15% of those people die. That's a preventable death. So anybody wants to go to the Holiday Inn and check in and get off of booze, I don't recommend it. But they didn't believe in detox, and I'm very grateful. They watched me closely, but I remember every living color and every shake. I've never forgotten it. I mean, they had a little slit in the wall where you put the plastic plate through, and plastic knives and utensils, and they sent me down there to get my food, and that was a joke because I couldn't get it through the damn slit in the wall, you know. So then they had an ingenious idea. They took it around and put my peas and my peas and my potatoes and brought it back and gave me a knife and a fork. And I was standing there trying to do that, and the peas were going up, and I was trying to get them coming down. You know, I'm grateful because I'm not exaggerating, really, because I could move as fast as those peas, you know. They weren't in the air, but I was going across the damn plate trying to get them. Finally, after 4 days in this thing, I'm getting better, and they send me down to watch TV, black and white TV, coat hanger antenna, eight seats here, a little boy from Kentucky sits there, and they got a guy back here on the back road that's catatonic schizophrenic. And he was on medication. They have a brain chemistry problem, not like ours, but screws up in many of the neuropharmacological areas like ours. And let me tell you, we're playing two bricks short of a full load. And if you think you can ever replace those two bricks, you're not going to make it. Just forget it. We are two bricks short of a full load, and we're going to stay that way. But he was back there, and they'd given him some medicine. And we got tools to deal with it. Like, they had to give him medicine. So he was where he could eat, and he'd come down there, and he would sit down, and we'd be watching TV, and he'd stand up 6'6", 250 pounds, and take off all of his clothes and stand there buck naked watching that television set. I'd look around and say, "Oh my God." I said, "What if he wants me?" And then I thought, "What if they give me to him, you know?" Took me 5 years in the program to admit those thoughts, I got to tell you that, but that's exactly the way I felt. Finally, it got where he'd come down, get naked every day, and we'd watch TV, and nobody seemed to care. Even I didn't care. We'd sit there watching TV. He's naked, and we're watching TV. So then I go to play ping pong with this guy, and I'm playing ping pong with him, and he goes back to his room, and ask me if I've seen him. I say, "No." They go down to find him. They find him hanging dead in his closet. So they come get us all together in the community room, said, "Let's go deal with our feelings." I said, "Y'all just get the hell away from me. Just get away from me." And I went into the room and closed the door, and I got down. I said, "God, why am I here? I'm on the inside. I'm not on the outside. I'm not the doctor." And I remember thinking, I don't know why, but I remember thinking, they didn't send me here to audit this course. That's all I can remember. And I thought, why am I here? And then I felt that voice that we come to feel and said, "Burns, you're an alcoholic." And I stood up and I said, "Thank you." And I went and called the psychiatrist and I said, "David, I'm an alcoholic." And he said, "Do you believe that?" I said, "Yeah, now I can come home getting therapy with you." And he said, "Wrong." I said, "What do you mean wrong?" He said, "You got to go to a treatment center in Atlanta."
I said, David, can I come home and wash my dirty underwear? He said, no, I'm going to even send somebody to get you. And I said, you mean you don't trust me? He said, you got it. I don't trust you. And I love it when we work with people new in the program. They come in and they say, I wasn't home for 2 weeks. I hadn't paid the bills. I came in with lipstick all over me. I slapped my wife. She told me to get out of the house. Well, I got out of the house and I came to my first AA meeting and I sat with you people and I knew that I had had an inspiration. And I went back and told her, I've been to AA. And she said, get your ass out of my house. And I don't understand it. You know? I mean, here we have this 5 seconds of inspiration with 21 years of bad road and we don't understand why nobody trusts us. You know? Isn't it wonderful? And it's incredible because that's what I call the great credibility gap. And the only thing that I've found that bridges that gap is to stay active in this program with time. With time. And it always clears up if we stay here and grow. So they sent me down to Atlanta and I did all the things I've told you about and came home, got into AA. That first year was total confusion. Total confusion. I would go into the room with a patient with my white coat on and my stethoscope, and I could practice medicine. I could remember that. Walk out in the hall and stand there and just start shaking and start crying. And I'd walk in, I'd pick up the phone, I'd call my sponsor, and I'd say, Jim, I'm flying apart. And he'd say, did you get up on time? And I'd say, yeah. And he said, you eat your breakfast? Yeah. Did you do your meditation? Yeah. Did you get the office on time? Yeah. You seeing your patients on time? Yeah. You'll be all right. Thanks, Jim. I'd hang up. 15 minutes later, I'd go back and call him again. Sometimes 6 and 7 times a day, I'd call this sponsor. And what I knew was that voice calmed me down. Calm me down. The night I got my token, 14 years ago, she gave me a party. I stood up and got that token, and they said, how do you feel? And I just cried. And they said, are you grateful? And I said, I don't know. Are you glad to be here? I don't know. How do you feel? I don't know. We went home for the party, and I went to bed. I didn't know. It was so scary and everything was so shaky. I went to see a psychiatrist, and for eight months, he would talk to me. And he'd say, on 2 times a week, Tuesday and Thursday, I was going to 4 and 5 AA meetings a week. I'd join the church, go into psychiatrist. Psychiatrist would say, well, we had a good session on Tuesday. What was it all about? This is on Thursday. I'd say, I don't remember. He'd say, you're blocking your therapy, you know. I thought, maybe he's right. Well, he was trying to feed steak to somebody that can't even eat mashed potatoes, you know. Finally, after 8 months, I said, Homer, it ain't you, it's me, and I don't know what the problem is. I got to go. Finally, after about a year and a half, it started to clear up, and I became little Mr. AA. Get up on time, eat your breakfast, do your meditation, get to your office, call your wife, eat your lunch, call your sponsor, get to the meetings, set up the chairs, set up the coffee, set up the ashtrays, get home at night, kiss your wife, do your meditation, go to sleep. Bum, 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 bum. Right? Right. Now, that's okay. Big Book says, as alcoholics, we are undisciplined. We allow God to discipline us in this way. And I was being disciplined in a whole new way of thinking. Novel concepts such as, if you don't want to be late, get up on time. Isn't that wonderful? That had escaped me. No, let's analyze why I don't get up on time. Maybe it's because of my brother, you know? No, Burns, get your dead butt up when you're supposed to, and you won't be late. Then finally, 8 years into the program, I mean, 5 years into the program, I am just like this. I have been perfect. I mean, the old-timers would look at me and say, how you doing? I'm doing fine. This is a smile, you idiot, you know? I was flying apart, and I was down in South Georgia at Thomasville, visiting a priest who was my spiritual advisor. We don't talk about spiritual advisors much anymore, but I had a spiritual advisor, and he was my next-door neighbor, an Episcopal priest. And I was down at visiting Jim and Casey Ruby, and I went back to the Holiday Inn, and I just was like this, and I dropped on my knees, and I said, God, take away the pain. Casey put her hands on my shoulder and said, call your sponsor. My sponsor was a 2-step sponsor. I was a 4-step member at that time, the first 3 steps and the 12th step. But he was a 1 in 12. His higher power was the group. Now, please understand, this is not a judgment. This is a report. I want to tell you that so you'll be able to recognize the miracle of what he said to me. I called Jim. I said, Jim, I'm flying apart. And he said, Burns, you're the most compliant person I've ever known. He said, do you think you'll ever get it? I said, Jim, please tell me, will I get it? He said, I think so. When you get home, we'll talk about it. I started to hang up the phone. He said, let me ask you something. I said, yeah. He said, do you believe if you get drunk tonight, it'll make you bad? I said, yeah, I do. He said, you're wrong. He said, do you believe if you work these steps perfectly, it'll make you good? I said, yes, I do. And he said, you're wrong. I said, I don't understand. He said, Burns, you've been trying to buy something that isn't for sale. It's given for fun and for free. God loves you just the way you are. You can't earn it, and you can't give it away. God loves you just the way you are. I tried to be perfect for Mama. She couldn't handle it. I tried to be perfect for me, and I couldn't do it. I tried to be perfect for God, and He didn't need it. The parable of the prodigal son, those years in the Baptist church, rang in my mind. Yes, I'd been the brother that was eaten up with resentments, and I'd been the drunk who came home. But the true parable is of the father who waits. You stick around this program. You'll find him. You'll find him. Spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Over the next 3 years, I was being led in a way that we've come to know many of us are led, into a position of where I could learn to live with unconditional love. All my life, I've taken hostages, or I've been one. My first hostage was my sponsor. I picked a man who loved to make people's decisions, and I loved to have him make my decisions. I took every problem to him, and he solved it. And then I took it to my pigeons and told them what to do. But I had no recovery of my own. His behavior became so aberrant that I couldn't even tolerate it. And people came to me and said, Burns, why are you putting up with this? This man was destroying people. And I said, because he gave me so much, and he did. He gave me a ton. Until I realized the reason I wasn't getting away from him is because I was scared to get away. I was scared not to have somebody make my decisions. Finally, I had to, and I got another sponsor. And I said, you know, we have but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He expressed Himself through our group conscience. And I looked at the group that we were in. I didn't trust the group and had every reason not to. I talked to this new sponsor, and he said, Burns, it'll be your choice, but you're going to have to change groups, I would imagine. And I changed all of my meetings and my sponsor at 8 years in the program. My biggest hostage was Casey. Oh, yeah, we had a wonderful relationship. I called her every morning at 10 and I said, I love you. I called her every afternoon at 3 and said, I love you. Except when at 10 I'd call her and she weren't there and she wasn't home, then I'd call her at 3 and say, I love you. Where in the hell were you at 10? I became her benevolent dictator. Oh, it was wonderful. We went to meetings together. We went everywhere together. It was a wonderful life so long as she did it my way. She came up to me and she said, Burns, I've never loved you more. I want to go back to school. I want to have my own program and go to my meetings. I want to go into therapy. And I said, honey, whatever you want, but I won't trust you, you bitch. I didn't say that, but it all clicked in just like that. The next thing that happened was, here she was going to go off and do her thing and leave me. And some of you remember deeply how much I was involved in that. There was only one obvious solution, right? Get another woman. So the fantasy clicked in just like that, and I found me another woman. That was my fantasy. I was going to have another woman. And I went to my new sponsor, and I said, Jack, I'm going to get another woman. He said, that's fine. You can get another woman, but you'll run her off just like you're running this one off. And I didn't know why. About that time, when the Spirit's willing, the teacher will arrive, and someone said that, a little pigeon of mine with three months of sobriety brought me in a group of about 7 or 8 tapes and said, would you see if these tapes are any good? And they were Joe and Charlie's tapes of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I listened to those tapes, and I knew the program that I didn't have. I knew the daily program I didn't have. I had 12 sets of those made. 8 of us got together, started a support group 6 years ago. It meets on Thursday night. We have been through slips. We've been through deaths. We've been through infidelity. And we have come to mold a trust group that is incredible. What I found in the process of studying that book was the very reason that I'm even on the face of this earth. I've always said, God, why am I even here? And then there it was. You're here to prepare yourself to be of maximum service to God and your fellow man. The third step prayer, the fourth step prayer, the seventh step prayer, the 11 step prayers, every one of them to be of service. Look for God's will and to be of service. I started out trying to find how to resolve what I could do with Casey, and I found what I really wanted to do was support her in being a college graduate. And last spring, she graduated number one in her class. And you know, I was a part of the solution rather than a part of the problem because of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and that message which says, be of maximum service. Somebody says, well, that's codependency. It's spirituality for me. In a vision for you, we can't give away what we haven't got, but by God, when I mean by God, when I got to that point, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've done what it said, I got a ton. From your experience and your strength and that roadmap, I've got a ton, and I'm willing to give it away. I'll go anywhere you want me to go. And I got a lot. And it's yours for the asking. And I said, what about unacceptable behavior? Read the line above the promises. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anybody. And read the line above that. If we are sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble, as God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anybody. Do you know what that can do for your self-worth when you're getting ready to meet an encounter with a board of medical license or even give a talk? And I stand there and I think, God, you're with me. I don't have to feel less than. I have served you well, and you have served me well. And I don't feel less than you. I don't feel better than you. I just feel ready and willing to be for you whatever you need. Whatever you need. Fifteen years ago, my daughter sat straddling my chest. I was passed out. She was strung out on amphetamine, Darvon, and Valium and alcohol. She tried to kill me. The reason she didn't is because she couldn't load an automatic shotgun. She came into AA 10 years ago, and 3 years ago she got married, and guess who she asked to give her away? Daddy. 7 years ago, my son flunked out of high school his senior year because of alcohol. Through a series of real spiritual preparations, and please don't try this without doing what I'm saying, spiritual preparation with a lot of guidance, he was put on the streets. He lived on the streets for about 2 months. I knew where he was all the time, and I don't know what I'd have done, but God would have given me the direction if he'd really crashed and burned. But he came to me after 2 months and said, Daddy, please get me into treatment. I said, okay, so put him into treatment. A year later, we were in a meeting together, and this woman raised her hand and said, my son went off to camp with two other boys, and they called him smoking dope, and I know my son's smoking dope, but I don't know how to help him. How can I help him? So a bunch of people talked. Finally, my boy raised his hand and said, I don't know what you can do to help her, but said, let me tell you what changed my life. Said, I watched my sister, somebody I'd really loved, become a real cheap person. She came into Alcoholics Anonymous and became a lady. What turned my life around is when my daddy was drinking, he would come home, lie to me and my sister. He'd tell us he'd do something he wouldn't. Then when he'd slap mother around, and finally she kicked him out of the house, he'd call us and tell him he's coming to get us to take us somewhere, and he wouldn't show up. So he came into Alcoholics Anonymous. He quit lying to us. I heard him one night tell mother he was sorry. He paid her some money that he owed her, and ever since then, he's never, never lied to us. He said, when I was out there on those streets, I came to know that I wanted to be just like my daddy. Final story is my father. I stood right there about 4 years ago and shared with this room on the gratitude night about how my daddy was forgetting my name. I remember how I said that story, and you just cringed if you remember when I said daddy didn't remember who I was. My mother died in 1978 after a terrible bout with metastatic breast cancer. I had a year of recovery to share with her, and really very little things to share, and not much garbage to clean up. Daddy's been somebody I had struggled hard to go talk about my alcoholism with my daddy, and he wouldn't talk to me about it. He's always been there for me, but he wouldn't talk about my alcoholism. He would turn and walk off. Today I know why, and I'm not privileged to share that with you. But I struggled to get him to talk to me about my alcoholism. Mother would talk about it. She didn't have a problem with it. Finally, you told me, quit forcing your daddy to do something that's causing him that much pain, so I quit. When Mother died, Daddy started to lose his memory. About 4 years ago, he'd lost his point. He didn't know me, didn't know my brother, even forgotten Mother. He thought I was my Uncle Buster, who was his brother. And interesting enough, my Uncle Buster was a roaring drunk and died that way. And I thought that was kind of interesting, but he thought I was Uncle Buster. I would call Daddy on the phone every Sunday night and talk with him, but I wouldn't say Daddy because that confused him. I'd just say Hal, that's his name. He'd say Buster, and we'd talk. 2 months ago, they put Daddy in a nursing home. And it was tough going down there, but I would go. The last time I went, this is about a month, maybe 2 months ago, I drove in and I parked the car, and I said, God, please let me be for Daddy what you want me to be. Please let me be for Daddy what he was for me. When I was playing football, I broke my leg, and Daddy came out and put me on a stretcher. I was playing basketball, broke my leg, Daddy came out and put me on a stretcher. Daddy was always there, but he never said much. God, please let me be for Daddy what you want me to be. I walked in, he was in the wheelchair, and he turned and said, Hi, Buster. And I said, Hi, Hal, how you doing? He said, Well, I need a shave. And I said, Fine. So I got shaved, Daddy. I said, Lunchtime? He said, Yeah. I said, Could we go to lunch? And so I rolled him in there to have lunch, and I got his plate, and I fed him, and Buster this, and Mama and Daddy doing this, and what have you seen about Daddy lately? And I'd say, Well, I haven't seen him in a while, Hal. Then my stepmother came in, sat down, and we talked for a while, and we rolled Daddy out on the sun porch. Now, always when Mother was alive, Mother and I would sit here in a conversation, and Daddy would sit over here just on the side, never said anything. Daddy just doesn't say anything. And Mother and I would go through these long, long dialogues and carrying on, and here my stepmother and I were carrying on talking and everything, and Daddy was just sitting over in a wheelchair looking. Finally, he said, Burns Mac, today you're just like the little boy your mother and I raised. Thank you for coming to see me. I love you very much. 30 seconds later, he didn't know who I was, and he never has since. You allowed me to become as a little child the greatest spiritual gift of all. And I thank you. I close every talk the same way. When I couldn't walk, talk, and chew gum, I listened to tapes. And I listened to Father Martin's tapes, The 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that tape, he says it in a way that's better than I could ever say it. You people are in my thoughts frequently. You're in my heart, and you're in my prayers always. I love you from the very bottom of my heart. I thank you for loving me. I thank you for letting me talk with you, and I thank you for listening. Conway, thank you for asking me. Charlotte, thank you for asking me too. For those people that I'm seeing again for another time, it's good to see you. For those people that I'm just getting to know, thanks for coming into my life. For those people I didn't get an opportunity to talk with, we trudge this road together. We will meet again. Until that time, Godspeed, good night, and I love you very much.